Okay, I'm going to start this morning with a little exercise, but it is a very dangerous exercise. Okay, it's a dangerous exercise for the first thing on a Sunday morning, because I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. All right, now I need you to promise, yes, exactly, Charlie, I need you to promise that when I ask you to close your eyes, that you are not going to fall asleep on me. Okay, so let's hold it together. We can do it. Take another sip of coffee. Okay, here we go. So here, close your eyes. And I want you to imagine, try to picture for yourself that you were there at day one of creation. Okay, you see in your mind, you can see the Spirit hovering over the face of what best I can describe as primordial waters. And you hear God say, "Let there be light." And instantly you are blinded by the sudden burst of brightness filling everything around you. But now I want you to imagine just a little before that. So take the VHS tape in your mind and do a little rewind. Okay? And you're a little bit before that, and you're there, and it's dark. And the waters themselves have just been created, but the earth is without form. Try to imagine in this moment the anticipation of what we just imagined, the anticipation of God speaking for the first time into creation. And now I want you to hit the rewind button in your mind one more time, and a little bit before that. There is nothing. We have crossed into Genesis chapter 1, verse 0 territory. We are before the words in the beginning, but here you have to understand there is no before, because there is no time at all. All right, open your eyes. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that very famous verse has within it the four fundamentals of physics, the four fundamentals of existence itself, captured in those 10 words. There is matter, earth. Okay. There is volume, space, heavens. There is force and action, God. And then there is the fourth one, time, in the beginning. Like all else ex nihilo, time itself was created at Genesis 1:1. And so of all God's attributes today, this one that we're going to talk about today might be one of the hardest to avoid words of accommodation, because we simply have no concept of what anything is like outside of time. I can have you close your eyes. I can tell you to try to remember what it's like before the beginning. But even then, in your mind, you are picturing the passage of time. You're there, and you're imagining a succession of moments up to a moment when suddenly waters appear, and suddenly light appears. But you have to remember that there was no succession of moments before time. Yes, Andrew. Right, exactly right. Yep. And so this passage of time, this succession of moments, is incredibly fundamental to our existence, because everything for us is a sequence of events, a succession of moments. I'm going to use that phrase a lot today. Okay, a succession of moments. Every one of even our thoughts that in some sense feel like they occur to us instantaneously, right, take time. We learn from the past. We are try to be, say, like mindful in the present, or present in the present, right, as folks would advocate nowadays. And we plan for the future, right? And of course, that also means, because we are in time, that we are very incredibly restricted by time. How often do we say that we want to pause? Right? Or we want to go back, Or maybe fast forward. But we cannot. We talk about a watched pot that never boils. Time flies when we're having fun. And the old sports writer's favorite saying when the superstar finally enters the twilight of his career is that the only undefeated opponent is Father Time. Right? So today we're going to talk about eternality. God is eternal. And the question that Barrett asks in chapter 8, for the title of the chapter, is God in time? Is God in time? So how do we define this notion? Sorry, I already missed it. So why is, in question 1 of the worksheet, why is God's eternality the hardest of all of God's attributes? To avoid words of accommodation, it's because we have no sense of what it means to be outside of time. And all of our language is wrapped up in time words. That's another phrase you're going to hear me say a lot today, okay? In time words. And by that I mean literally in timeline, as opposed to outside of time. We have, our language is literally based on the notion of past tense, present tense, future tense, right? And I'm going to use past tense words today about God, but understand that that's wrong. Because there is no past tense when it comes to outside of time. There's not even really present tense, but we're going to try. Okay? We're going to try. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. 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 Yeah, Andrew's right. I'm sorry, but there's going to be moments where you're going to think I'm talking about Star Trek, right, today. But it is what it is. So, like we said at the beginning of the class, today is a very good day to take that metaphorical duct tape and wrap it around your skull. So that when it explodes later, you can find all the pieces, okay? So let's start by trying to define God's eternality, okay? Now, the word that the Bible uses a lot is everlasting, okay? Everlasting. And we see that in places like 1 Chronicles 16, Isaiah 9, Isaiah 26. In fact, can I just, I want to read all three of those references. So can I just have three volunteers, please, who have Bibles semi-ready. Yes, you want to start, Daniel? You can have 1 Chronicles 16:36, Mark, Isaiah 9:6, Charlie, Isaiah 26:4, please. All right, Daniel, you're first, if you've got it. From everlasting to everlasting. Right, everlasting Father. Okay, Charlie? Oh, hey, we brought Rock, too. Woo! Two metaphors for the price of one on that verse. Everlasting rock, okay? So, we hear everlasting, and you have to understand there is a sense in that word of time, right? This is an in-time word, everlasting. So it is a word of accommodation for us. Because when we see everlasting, it's an adjective to describe our experience with God. God is, Einstein relativity here, God is everlasting with respect to us, right? Or compared to us, who are in time. Here we are posited at this present moment. Oops, sorry, we just missed it. We're a little further along. But here we are posited in this present moment, and we can go backwards everlasting, and there's still God. And we can go forward everlasting, and there's still God, right? That's the from everlasting to everlasting. And the other two everlastings that we saw today are forward facing, right? So eternality, here's one sort of succinct, let's just go with this as a working definition, okay, for the first part of the class. And we'll see how well it holds up as we discuss, all right? It's almost like a catechism sort of answer, right? God is eternal. God created time and exists outside of it. God created time and exists outside of it. Okay? Like we said at the beginning, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, that is the start of time. Any thoughts on that? Have you ever tried to imagine what it must be like? God outside, Jonathan? I don't know. Yeah, I love that comment from Augustine. Yeah, he's like, if you don't ask me, I feel pretty confident I know what time is. But if you want me to explain it, I suddenly don't feel very confident at all. Charlie? Yes. What'd you say? Don't get ahead of the teacher. Yeah. So I think what's important to understand is when we're talking about eternality, is that he exists outside of time, right? That's what I'm, so for the definition of that. But you are completely right, particularly when we're talking about the incarnation, right? That God chose to enter, as Charlie's, one of his favorite phrases has been, right? He's chosen to enter time-space continuum for us, right? In the person of Jesus Christ. The second person of the Godhead, right? So yes, he exists in time. So it's less to say that he exists in time so much as that he enters and interacts in time with us who are the time-bound creatures, right? Yeah. Into our time, into our experience, right? Yeah, good segue to this, which is number two. Bodhi Hodge, who's one of the apologists for Answers in Genesis, he says, God didn't come from anywhere or anyone. God is the source of everything, and he created time. Time is not absolute. God is absolute. When someone asks where God came from or who created him, they are assuming that time is absolute and God isn't. But this is not the God of the Bible. Right? Time is not absolute. God is absolute. All right, so number three, these attributes, right? We've looked at all these attributes previously, and they all have connections to the idea of God being eternal. God is subject to no limitations, and he is the source of all things. What would limit God? If he, in terms of what we're talking about today, what would limit him? Well, if he is subject to no limitations, but he's the source of all things, hypothetically, what would limit him? Yes, but I mean specifically with what we're talking about today about eternality. What would be a limiting thing to God? What are we limited by? Time. So if God existed in time, would he'd be limited by it, right? He'd be subject to a present and a future and a past. There would be a time before God was, or there certainly would be a time before God did something, right? Like there's all that type of thing. So existing in time would limit God. So that's, what is that attribute that we talked about God having no limitations? Anybody remember? It's the Latin one. Aseity, yep. Aseity, so you can connect the line there. Existing in time would limit God, but aseity tells us that God has no limits. Okay. Here's another one. The next one, God is not a composition, right? So to compose or decompose is an action that would happen in time. But what attribute of God tells us that he does not compose or decompose? Simplicity, right? Simplicity. Simplicity tells us that he is in his attributes in all their fullness to the absolute degree. He is them. Right? All time. Okay? And then the last one, God is once, Anselm, this is a good one. God is once, simultaneously, and unendingly. Right? His eternality is a shield against all kinds of, the opposite of the word, right? You already know what it is, right? Immutability. It's the last one. A shield against all kinds of mutability. You cannot talk of change that it was or will be. It does not exist in a changeable way. It is what is once, simultaneously, and unendingly. Any kind of succession in time would introduce a change in God. Right? But we know God does not change. because of the attribute immutability. Right? So there you go. So that's the three connections. All right, so at this point, I'm going to have to use an in-time word. And even though, as I said a few minutes ago, any in-time word is a divine accommodation, but here goes. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the notion of God being eternally present. Eternally present. But present is an in-time word, but we're going to just try to use it as a way to picture what's going on here. Okay? He is eternally present. Now, Andrew, last week, and myself the week before, we talked of God always doing, right? Always in motion. Do you remember that? There was a Latin phrase for that, that Anselm coined. Anybody remember the Latin phrase? It's really close to English, so it's not too hard. What's that? Something momentum. We're getting there. Purus actus. What did that mean? Pure act, right? God is pure act. Sorry, that wasn't Anselm, that was Aquinas. Aquinas coined that phrase, my bad, the other A-team guy. I think I could keep him straight by now. that God is always doing, right? He's the first mover. And I mentioned how when we were talking about immutability, this was one of the refutations of the notion of God being like rigidly immobile. Right, the fact that there is motion in the universe, that if God were rigidly immobile, then there would have been nothing to kick off motion happening in existence. But he is the first mover, and thus things move. Right, he's the source of movement, the source of action. But, all right, when we think about the notion of God being pure act, is that here comes the objection from the skeptic. The skeptic would say that to act or to will anything seems to suggest some kind of succession of moments. Right? I wasn't doing something and now I'm doing something. Right? Or even if we, go with pure act, it's like, well, God was doing something first and then he's doing something else. Right? Is sort of the thing we would potentially start. That's what the skeptic would argue. That there's a series of acts that stem from the will of God. Okay? Now, there is an urban legend, Christian myth, I don't know how you want to say, about Augustine, that supposedly someone once asked him, what was God doing before he made heaven and earth? And Augustine supposedly replied, God was preparing hell for idiots that ask questions like that. Yeah, that's the kind of urban legend we can get behind, right? But actually, I do like being a mythbuster, so I'll say this. What's fascinating is there's a lot of truth to this myth in that someone really did ask Augustine that question, but he didn't find that answer all that funny. And in fact, what it was is that other people had answered that. He had heard that joke of an answer, and he wrote a little treatise refuting, rebuking the people who were telling that joke. And ironically, somehow, over the mists of course of time, now we associate it as if Augustine was the one who said the joke when he was actually writing about how we shouldn't say that joke. I feel bad for him. He felt like it was evading the force of the question with crude humor. Augustine said, I would have preferred him to answer, I am ignorant of what I do not know, rather than reply so as to ridicule someone who has asked a deep question and to win approval for an answer, which is a mistake. It's pretty good. But Augustine, in true Augustine fashion, his real response, not nearly as pithy, and he goes on for many, many pages to give... this long discourse about the nature of time, and I don't have the time to go through the whole discourse about the nature of time. But Anselm, he comes along a few hundred years later, and he gives us a nice pithy summary of Augustine's thing. And he says, God has no temporal present. God has no temporal present. And so if he's not temporally present, that leaves us only with eternally present. Temporally present would be the notion of, that you've probably heard before, time stretched out. Right? Sometimes some people have tried to use the analogy when we're talking about eternality that like, it's that God sees time stretched out. Right? And experiences time stretched out. That would be a temporal present. Yeah. Yes. It's the same concept as those who, some Arminian folks would like to say, like, that God can look down the corridors of time and see, you know, ahead of time who would believe on his name and so thus predestine those folks to salvation. Yeah, Charlie. For Calvary and, yes, in this, yes, in the eternal present. Yes. Yeah, I didn't mention that earlier, but thanks, Charlie, for bringing that up, which is that even angels clearly experience time, right? So, and in heaven, when Jesus talks about everlasting life and eternal life, that kind of eternal that he's talking about is the passage of time. So it is not that time is going to go away for us, right? I think we will always be temporally bound creatures with God in the everlasting. And to that end, it's why I say that this feels, although I don't hear a lot of theologians talking about it when I read, I don't read a lot of theologians talking about it, but the eternality, I think, is one of those incommunicable attributes of God, that no one but God exists outside of time. Not even the other spirit beings. Right, yeah, yeah. There's a transition, yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, sorry.
So you think heaven is infinite time and not no time?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm going with for now. Yeah.
It's a line.
It's a line, yes, yes. Dave. Yeah, possibly. I mean, there's also, as Andrew's saying, that there's a new heaven and a new earth, so there's also the possibility that time is different, right, in the new time. But God doesn't really give us much clue or hint about what it will be like. Other than that, it will be everlasting in the terms of our ability to understand them right now, right? Oh, yes, yes. He's visible as, yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah. Right, yeah.
In the Revelation, you have martyred saints in heaven asking God how long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, What I want to say, just to go back to the idea about time stretched out and temporally present, is that I want you to understand that God experiences no duration. Okay, he experiences no duration. Because a lot of people where they get confused where they do this timeline stretch out thing for God is that they say that God has an unending timeline. And I say, no, God has no line at all. Right, and that's, I know, but, right, no. No, I just think I think that verse is an accommodation in that we could maybe paraphrase it a different way to say that to God, you know, 1,000 years is nothing, to God a day is nothing, right? Or as to Charlie's puddle analogy, right, that they're both part of the same puddle. I am, however, restricted by time, and I'm running out of it. Sharon, go ahead, but then we got to move on. That's okay. Right, exactly right. Yeah, well, but whatever, regardless. God has no beginning. I think we can very clearly say that compared to all else, right? That everything else, because it is sourced from him, has a beginning. I know that's an in-time word, but let's just go with it, right? you know, all else is created, it has a start, that God is the only one who is eternal in both directions. So, all right. So, again, let's try to deal with the question of succession and acts. And let's answer this objection from the skeptic, okay? If he is timeless, eternal, how can he also be purus actus? Well, let me first ask this, all right? Is there an order to God's decrees? Can somebody give me an example? Is there an order to God's decrees? Sure, yes. Yep, there's a decree to create mankind, then there's a decree to create for the fall. There's 6 days of creation, right? There's an order to that.
This is not capital D decree, right?
Yep. Okay. Yep, what else? You got one?
Well, no, God's decree is singular.
Sure, okay. So, yes. Yes?
Different covenants.
Different covenants, okay. Anybody else have another example? Yes, right. Yep. Now, in all those, does the fact that there is an order, okay, then ipso facto require that they happen in succession? Yes. But where are they unfurling?
In time.
There we go. Yes, in our terrarium of time. Yes, that's very good. Yes. The theologically precise terminology here is to say, so they're occurring in time, but when did they, I'm going to hate saying this word, originate? Before time, outside of time, right? So was there a succession in how they originated? No. Right? And so, like I said, the theologically precise terminology here is to say that God's acts and decree and will have a logical order, but not a temporal one, okay? A logical order, but not a temporal one. And this is, I can't even say the word. What is the superlapsary, that stuff, right? Yeah, superlapsary, like this is like deep seminary. This is what seminary students argue about on their free time kind of thing, but... But I'm not even going to try to explain it. But I mean, this is, you know, or ordo salutis, right? Same idea. Are we going to let's argue over the order of how salvation works, right? Does justification come before, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? So Barrett gives a really cool analogy, I think, about a light switch when it comes to logical order, all right, versus temporal order. And that is, if I walk into a room and I flip on the light switch, the light turns on. Okay, now, temporally speaking, they seem to us as if they are instantaneous, right? Switch, light, okay? The light does not cause the switch to flip, though. The logical order is switched, flipped switch equals light on, right? Switch has to come first, then light. And so that's logical ordering, right? That outside of time, this order was originated in together, the same time, except not time. Sorry. I can't do it. right, but there's a logical order to them. Okay, but just because there's a logical order, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. I'm trying to argue from a very hypothetical point of view, but it's a hypothetical with a real, actual real basis in reality, that there can be a logical order without necessarily there being a temporal ordering. Okay? Whew. All right, do you remember with the lessons on God's immutability that we talked about, and we sort of talked about this already, that when we spoke of the God's, the things about God that do not change. Yeah? And one of the things about that God that do not change is God's purposes, all right, his purposes. And what did it mean when I said that? I said that God's purposes do not change. I said maybe another P word besides purposes would be plan, right? God's plan does not change. So it essentially means that God's plan. He's always had the same plan for history, right? From before the foundation of the world. The same plan for salvation, the same plan for how he deals with us. And we see, we in time see a progression. We see that the calling of Abraham was step one. We see Exodus maybe step two, Davidic covenant step three, incarnation of Jesus step four, right? And I'm not arguing that these are the actual steps, but I'm just saying, you know, there's steps, right? Maybe step 10, I should have just skipped the numbering. But that does not mean that God is changing from step two to step three, right? But rather that it's the same plan that was always was that's now being executed. The plan is the plan. And we said, does God change his mind? And we answered, no. We saw lots of times about the Hebrew word that was used for God's repenting in all those Old Testament passages. Does anybody remember what the Hebrew word was? Let me get it out of your throat. Nachem. Okay, Nachem. And it is the word of that has a sense of to breathe strongly, to be sorry, to pity, or as the ESV translates it, to regret or relent, right? Old translations use the word repent because it was sort of an idea of regret as well with repenting, and ESV, other modern ones tend to say regret or relent. But the breathing strongly one is the one that I found the most interesting because I sort of have that anthropomorphic picture of, right? So when 1 Samuel 15, it talks about God regretting, relenting of making Saul king, you sort of get the sense of like, with Saul, right? But Samuel also told us that the glory of Israel will not lie or have regret, for he is not a man that he should have regret. And what we talked about there to explain that was the notion that the distinction between God who can regret things with foreknowledge, right? He can regret making Saul king, but he always knew what was going to happen when he made Saul king. Whereas us, when we regret things, it is because we didn't know what was going to happen, right? I can regret taking the turnpike to get to work one morning because of the traffic, because I didn't know that the traffic was going to be bad, or I didn't know there was going to be a big accident, right, and thus making me late to work. Or I can regret eating the scallops. Always regret eating the scallops. Because I didn't know they'd give me the food poisoning, right? And one commentator had told us that God may be capable of looking back on the very act of bringing something about and lamenting that act in some regard, but affirming it still as best in another regard. And Andrew, you told us what's the perfect analogy for us as parents here? Discipline. Right? Where you know it's best, you still don't like it. Right? You regret having to discipline your children, but you know it is the best thing to do. So if God can say, I feel sorrow that I made God king, is not the same as saying, I would not make him king if I had to do it over. Right? That's not the kind of regret that God has. So I reviewed all that just to reemphasize the point that there is no change here with respect to God. Because if there was any kind of possibility of that change, then that means that God would have potential. And as Andrew taught us last week, God has no potential. All right? I know that sounds bad. Right? We always want to talk about like, yes, it's great. Yo, you have potential. Way to go. Right? But truly to have potential means is kind of a damning with faint praise because it means that you haven't actually reached that potential yet. Right? Well, he's got great potential. Yeah, Dave. This answer has great potential, I can tell. Yeah. Yes. Oh, man. Thanks. Thank you. Right. It was better. It wasn't better for Judas, is the idea. It was best in that it was the best of the plan for existence, for everyone, you know, like, as Romans 8 says, the good of them who love him, right? It would have been better for Judas himself to not have been born, but that doesn't mean it was not the best for the order of God's plan. Yeah, Charlie. I mean, because think about what amazingness he did write about, and yet there was things he could not write. Yes. Yep. All right, let me define answer number five here so we can put a bow on this particular part of the discussion. So to define logical ordering, theologically speaking, is the order of the observed results of God's decree as they relate to each other in terms of cause and effect. Okay, not in terms of succession of time, but in terms of cause and effect. This one happens first, it causes this, the effect is that, which then causes this, which the effect is that. So on and so on. Okay? All right. God's eternality, though, is very good news for us. It's very good news for us. Why? Well, Romans 8, 29 and 30. A lot of people call that the golden chain, right? The golden chain. Can somebody quote that right off the top of their head or just read it for us? Romans 8, 29 to 30. How many Awana? We have no Awana kids in here this morning. Awana leaders, anybody? All right, well, I'll wait and let somebody look it up. You don't want to get it wrong in front of the whole crowd of people, I understand. Yes, sir, in the back, go for it. Right, okay? That's the chain, right? Foreknew, predestined, called, justified, glorified, right? Okay, there we go, that's the chain. Now, all of these are experienced by us as temporal creatures, temporally, however you want to say it, right? But not so for God, and that's the great news about this chain, not so for God. They were ordained by God eternally before time. Barrett uses the phrase, he says that they were cemented in the mind of God in timeless eternity. But even that isn't really a great way to talk about it because it's using that past tense word cemented, as if there was a past tense to it, that there was once a moment in time in God's mind where we weren't predestined and now there is, because no, right? It is outside of time, eternal, present, always cemented. Which is why we have nothing to fear about anything in time, as Romans 8 goes on to say, nothing to fear about anything in time to have any possible opportunity to break that golden chain. Because it's cemented outside of time. Our salvation is outside of time, secure in the eternal mind of our eternal God. That's a joy. Understand that there isn't even a when to God's promises. You know, I make a promise and there is a time at which that promise will be executed, right? That I then also have to follow through with said promise. Not so for God, because there's not that, he is not bound by that when. At the outside of time, that he makes the promise, he is executing the promise. It's already executed. It is cemented, as Barrett says. It's no wonder that his personal name is, I am that I am. Right? As sort of like emphasizing the present of him. Right? I am that I am. That's the very good news about his eternality. So let me conclude by doing a callback all the way back to chapter 4, when we spoke about God's aseity, and I quoted the Greek philosopher Heraclitus. Anybody remember that guy? Chapter 4, that was like 4 score and 16 weeks ago, I think. Okay? Heraclitus, he had this quote that, it's a very philosopher quote. On those stepping into rivers, staying the same, other and other waters flow. Right? Interpretive dance time. On those stepping into rivers, staying the same, other and other waters flow. Right? And Plato paraphrased him by saying, essentially, like, you can't step into the same river twice. Right? Thanks, Plato. But Heraclitus was pretty dense, and the you know, the probably a better way to, or Plato's little way of doing it is not really getting it perfectly. It's the notion of that the statement is on its surface paradoxical, but it's not supposed to be taken false or contradictory. It makes perfectly good sense in this. We call a body of water a river precisely because it consists of changing waters. That's what makes it a river. If the waters did not flow, if they did not change, it would cease to be a river. It would instead be a lake or a dry stream bed. So there's this sense in which the river is this remarkable kind of existent, the philosophers say, one that remains what it is by changing what it contains. If the river remains the same, one can surely step in twice, but not into the same waters, to be sure, but into the same river. Okay? So, and again, what that tells us is that our only perception of being, ourselves, when we talk about being, is of things that are changing. A river is a river, but every moment it is made up of different water. We are people, but every moment we are made up of slightly different molecules. We breathe in, we breathe out, and there's a little bit of carbon of me that's no longer there that was there a second ago. But yet I still am me. Charnock, Stephen Charnock, says that God isn't a river. He says that God is an ocean. That he's fixed and stable and overwhelmingly huge. He calls him an unbounded sea of being. I really like that quote, an unbounded sea of being. And Barrett takes it further. He says, while the river of time is always changing and developing, the ocean of the divine remains constant, consistent, and invariable. He is changed by no succession of moments, for he has none. He has no beginning. He has no end. He just is. Remember, it was back in chapter 4, I told you, it was R.C. Sproul who said that the real way that we should talk about human beings is that we are actually human becomings. And that there is only one true being, and that is God. That is God. Acts 17:28, in him we live and move and have our being. He is the eternal one. Right. Yes, Dave. No. Maybe not exactly. Maybe because we have no data. We have no frame of reference to talk about it. Other than that, he was and is. Like, again, you threw in the word before. Yes, exactly right. Yeah. Yes, Daniel. Right. Right. Yes. Yes. But again, we're breaking everything and trying to use the word before, right? But yeah. Are changing, right, yeah, yeah.
Requires time, and so purus actus as a description requires time as its basis.
Yes, yeah, 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 yeah. So I think there's the notion of, with respect to creation, right, God, yeah, yeah, Charlie. Yes. Yes, 9 days ago, that potential energy. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because now multiply that out across billions and billions of stars that are all exuding an amount of energy that is unfathomable to us all across the cosmos.
Yeah.
And God, yeah, exactly. And it didn't like drop his energy at one iota. Yes. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Well, if you'll permit me one last moment of indulgence, I just wanted to say, yesterday we had Pastor Bob's memorial service here, and lots of people got up and said something about Pastor Bob, and I wasn't, you know, one of the speakers or whatever, and I just wanted to take a moment, though, because the thing I most interacted with Pastor Bob would be here in Sunday school, when I was teaching Sunday school, and I loved having him here in the audience. He was fantastic at knowing just the right time to rescue me. when he could tell that, you know, it was time to chime in with some amazing insight. And, you know, and lots of people yesterday in the service talked about just the intelligence he had that God gifted him with, and what a blessing it was then to all of us. And there was nothing that made me feel better about teaching Sunday school than when Bob would come up to me afterwards to tell me what a great job I had done. And it just meant so much. He never pulled rank, which was the other thing that I just was really amazed by. That, you know, he could have, right, like founding pastor, so to speak. But he never pulled rank. He never, you know, corrected those of us who were up here teaching in that way. And instead, he'd come up, he would, you know, just encourage, just so encourage, and tell us what a great job. I think all of us as Sunday school teachers all had this experience at one point or another, where he'd come up and tell us what a great job we were doing, how thankful he was for it. He'd give us like a little suggestion of, oh, next time, you know, if you're going to talk about it next week, you should mention so-and-so, you know, and just, it was just amazing. And I'm just so thankful for that ministry, that small part of his giant ministry, but that small part, that was how he ministered to me. So I just want to close in prayer and thank God for him. Heavenly Father, Lord, I thank you so much for this time that you give us each week in Sunday school, and to give us a time to discuss together and build each other up. It's an amazing moment in the life of our church body in which we can share with each other the knowledge that you have gifted to each one of us, and allow us to think through things and just challenge each other, sharpen each other, and really grow and deepen our faith. And Lord, we thank you especially today for the gift of Pastor Bob and how he participated in that here in our Sunday schools. And we miss him dearly, Lord, but we thank you for that which you did give him to give to us. And thank you for all those times in which he enriched these discussions. I know, Lord, that he is having a great time right now, having discussions like that in heaven with all the redeemed saints of all time. And we look forward to seeing him again, that we are sad, with great hope and expectation of being together with him and all of us again. In Jesus' name, amen.